It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.
Public health infrastructure represents the backbone of our nation's health security, yet decades of chronic underfunding have left the system fragile and increasingly vulnerable. In this episode of Care Talk, Dr. Stella Saffo of Civic Health Alliance discusses the current dismantling of public health institutions and what the healthcare sector can do to defend and strengthen these critical systems. Welcome to Care Talk Live, a weekly American healthcare policy show and podcast where we explain how healthcare works or doesn't work and get you answers. I'm Laura Packard, cancer survivor and healthcare advocate, here to help you. Please subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts to get future Care Talk shows. From advocacy and policy change to institutional partnerships and investments, in today's episode, we'll discuss current strategies to protect public health's future and focus on how healthcare can be a force for public health resilience. So welcome to Dr. Stella Saffo, the co-founder and executive director of Civic Health Alliance, a nonpartisan coalition of health and civic leaders for the advancement of America's health through civic engagement in care settings and communities. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with talking about the dismantling of public health infrastructure under the past year or so. What's been happening to our public health systems?
So I think this has started really before the past year, and it's just gotten much more acute. In medicine, we talk about acute on chronic, meaning you have a chronic problem and then it gets acutely worse. So for example, you may have acute on chronic kidney disease exacerbation, and really that's what's happening to public health. Public health in general has been underfunded, right? And part of it is because when public health works well, you don't see it. You get clean water, your restaurants serve you clean food, things just kind of work. And so we don't have this mentality that we need to be thinking about it all the time and investing in it. Whereas in healthcare, like hospitals, you know, if we don't invest in those hospitals, the hospital will close and you won't have a place to go if you have a stroke or you're delivering a baby or whatever else. So public health historically, I think, has been not as funded and as kind of resourced as it needs to be. So when you have what's happened in the last year, which is forces that are coming in that are really dismantling it and creating mis and disinformation around public health, and we can talk more about what that's looked like, the foundation that it started on wasn't that great anyway. People don't have a great understanding of why you need public health and what it means to have a strong public health infrastructure. So it makes it easier to then dismantle that infrastructure. And we end up where we are now, where we're seeing the rise of measles, the closing or the divestments in really important public health institutions like the CDC. All this stuff is really scary, but it's a symptom of, as a community, our lack of understanding, I think, of the importance of public health. And again, along with some of the active malice that I would say is coming from our federal government as it relates to investing in public health.
Mm-hmm. And this is the year 2026. And a few years ago, we were in the midst of a deadly pandemic where the importance of public health became a lot clearer, I think, when people realized that whether your neighbor has access to healthcare, whether a community has access to healthcare, affects everyone in that community. How do we get so far away from that now?
You know, I think about that a lot. I think, you know, about how 5-6 years ago during the pandemic, people clapped in New York City. We would clap at the end of the night for our healthcare heroes. And really, as part of that, for our public health heroes who were helping to keep all of us safe. And now it's almost a dirty word and people want Fauci's, you know, like they want Fauci prosecuted, right? How did that happen? I think it happened in a couple of ways. And I think that we are somewhat culpable for that. We're somewhat to blame. Because I think one of the things that we don't always do well in science in general, in the science world, is we don't always explain well what it is that we're doing and why it is that we're needed. And so what people remember of the time of COVID is mandates and being restricted and being forced to not do things that they really wanted to do, right? And that's in part because the story that we allowed to be told was around things like mandates and the politicization of, you know, what events can be held or not held. And I think that what we've gotten away from is the real story, which is, my goodness, how much worse could this pandemic have been had we not had some of these things happen? What are some of the success stories of getting the vaccines out and the lives that it saved? We never got to tell that story. And so this kind of politics of public health, you know, that's happened because of both parties, I'd argue, has left us in a place where people see public health as being very associated with a certain political leader that they don't like or a certain, you know, policy that they don't like. And that kind of conflating lets it be that we walk away from the actual help that this field provides and really safety that it provides to all of us.
Mm-hmm. And if we go back to a few years ago, my stepfather died alone with COVID in a nursing home facility. And it feels like when public health is demonized and when people don't have access to vaccines and healthcare that they need, we're looking at returning all these diseases coming back because maybe people don't remember how bad they were, or because public health is unseen when it's successful, the bad things don't happen. And how can we break free of this to have Americans be protected without having to lose our friends and family to these diseases again?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, it's gotten so bad that it does have to get really personal for folks to understand it. Like, for example, I wasn't alive during, you know, I wasn't born yet when polio was bad. But I have patients who will talk to me about, oh, yeah, there was this summer and everyone got polio and so-and-so, you know, lost his ability to walk. And there's just this real sense of it touching them in a way that I think a generation hasn't necessarily had. I was one of the folks who had chickenpox back in the day because chickenpox was still going on then. And, you know, you do the calamine lotion and you're itchy everywhere, you're someone from school. There's a whole group of folks who didn't have to have chickenpox because we had the vaccine, right? And so I think that there's a little bit of, sadly, and I say this with the most regret like ever, I think there's a little bit of we have to experience it again, that has to happen for our generation, for the folks who are around and in power now, to be able to kind of understand what it means. And measles is a great example. To watch your loved one, your child, die of measles is so horrific. And, you know, measles is coming back. It's spreading in the US, thousands of cases. Thank God it hasn't gotten quite as like epidemic as it has the potential to. But God forbid, if that happens and we get the mortality numbers that we get and people are having to bury their children or having long-term impacts, you know, hearing loss and other things that can happen, the conversations start to change a little bit. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, I do think that to kind of reinvest in public health and to want to do the work of reinvesting in public health, you have to start local, right? Because maybe in my community, I'm not worried about measles, but I am worried about the opioid crisis. And if the public health office of my community can help me really address that, and I can see the value in how they address that, then I'm kind of bought in, and I'm I'm walking with them along this journey of let's fix this issue. Some communities, it's violence. Some communities, it's, you know, there's so many issues that I think different individuals and different communities prioritize. And so I don't think it's a blanket kind of let's all work on this one thing and people will see the value. I think it has to be hyper-local. And sadly, I think that we're going to learn the hard way. Although some folks can say, didn't we learn with COVID? Apparently not. Apparently we're a species that has to see it many times over. But I think that that's part of what's going to really bring it to a head. And it's why I believe that public health will rebuild and will get better, because we can't, as a strong and civilized society, if you will, we can't do what we want to do without a really strong public health foundation. So we're going to have to return to those roots.
Mm-hmm. And I just keep thinking of the family in New Mexico where their unvaccinated child died of measles. And I think it was a reporter that asked them, you know, would you vaccinate? Will you vaccinate the rest of your kids? And they were still strongly believed if you're supporting losing your child versus vaccination because of influencers and myths and disinformation, you know, if people are really dug in on their beliefs and even losing family members won't change them, I don't know how you get people to the point where they understand the effects of not having a vaccine, not having public health, because if they've already lived it and that's just hardened their thoughts on this even further, because, you know, none of us are good at admitting that we've made a mistake, or maybe accepting the idea that vaccination is important and saves lives means that you're at fault for your child dying. And nobody is going to be able to accept that easily, that responsibility. So what do we do about that? That even when people face the consequences of these choices, it doesn't change their minds and hearts.
I think that there is a real requirement that we have. And one of the things that we're doing with Civic Health Alliance is a campaign called 1000 Caring Voices, where we're really inspiring people to become champions in their communities and to talk to each other. I think that there's something so powerful about the messengers that you send. So in the case that you described, it's a reporter asking a question, this person's kind of, you know, on a national platform answering and thinking about their neighbors and others who might be watching them, right? And there's a real, you know, we're, as human beings, we're very social animals, we're parts of our groups. And so maybe it's that it would be hard to admit this mistake in a public forum, right? But if you can imagine this idea of like champions, people who go into your community, who are trusted messengers in your community, it's how we did the work around COVID vaccine uptake, right? And there's conversations that are had at that local level. I'd love to ask that family, you know, when your child became sick, you took him to the hospital. Why did you take him to the hospital? What do you trust in the hospital? What don't you trust in the hospital? And what about, you know, your doctor's office or vaccinations, do or don't you trust? To some of the influencers who are saying, don't take vaccines, you know, there's conversations to be had there. And I think what's happening is in the world where, you know, COVID happened and we had to do mandates and kind of blanket, you know, kind of clinical sterile policies in the place of human to human interaction, I think it's made it harder for us to really see and understand each other. And so in the case of that example you gave, which I think is a brilliant example of, man, what if people are just so far convinced that you can't, you know, even a death or even, a direct hit doesn't convince them. I think that those are the smaller minority. I really do. And I think that that small minority can be reached through trusted messengers, through people in their community who look like them, who lived like them, who live like them, who can have those conversations and little by little by little continue to move it forward. God forbid, you know, they don't vaccinate the rest of their kids. What if another one of their babies passes away? And another, because, you know, measles is highly, highly infectious in that way. At some point, there are some sentinel things that move people. And it shouldn't take that. It shouldn't take even one person getting sick for us to get to that point. But I do think that if we are sending in the right folks to have some of these conversations, even the kind of hardened, you know, sides can be moved down the line.
And I think also it's important to assign blame and responsibility where it belongs. If somebody doesn't have access to medically accurate information in their community, and all they're hearing are lies from influencers that are making money off this mis and disinformation, the blame belongs at the source of the inaccurate information and how they're spreading it. So what do you think about influencer culture, and why are non-professional people being taken more seriously than doctors?
Because we as doctors don't always know how to communicate. It's a simple thing. So I do HIV primary care. I've had patients come into my office who've had HIV for 15 years, 20 years. And, you know, I'll explain to them what's going on with their disease. We'll talk more. And at the end of the visit, they'll say, "Doc, you're the first person that's really helped me understand my HIV." These are individuals who've been in the healthcare system for a decade at least, and yet they haven't gotten that understanding. Am I some kind of magician? No, but one of my superpowers as a doctor is that I can communicate in really simple, clear ways. It's not always what we're taught. It's not always how we work. In the medical field, we're really thinking about complicated diagnoses and procedures, but just that simple communication isn't always there, right? And think about it, access. Can you get access to your doctor when you have a random question about, can I take the supplement or not? Nope, you got to make an appointment. It takes 3 months. When you get there, you have 15 minutes. You have all these things to go over. You don't get to ask them a simple question. Whereas social media with influencers, you can go and look up anything at any time. They're always available. They talk your language. They seem accessible. They seem like you. And so, you know, this isn't to say that we need more science communicators and doctors to become influencers. It isn't to say that, but it's to say, what is it about the way that we've set up the healthcare system where people don't feel like they can trust us, right? Certain marginalized groups don't feel like they can trust healthcare providers or healthcare, or they don't feel like they can access us to ask us some of these basic questions. And how do we change that? I think in the future, when we've had to redesign public health and possibly healthcare, you know, in this kind of future states that we're heading towards, because things are breaking, and when things break, you rebuild them. We've had to do that rebuilding. I think we're going to really ask ourselves that question in a much deeper way and get at the heart of it. Why do you listen to this influencer before you listen to your doctor? And the answers will be, I don't have a doctor, or I can't get to my doctor, or I don't understand my doctor. And once we start to get those answers, we have to go back and say, how do we do this better? And that's the place that I want to be at. Because when we go to school, I trained for 12 years to become a physician. This is something that I feel so passionately about it, because the knowledge that I hold can help my patients to live better lives, right? It is my responsibility to get that knowledge to them. How do we do that better? And that's the charge that we need to kind of think about designing around better for the future.
Thank you very much for joining us. And can you repeat how people can find out about the work that you're doing and other physicians are doing this year?
Sure. So I am a co-founder for an organization called Civic Health Alliance. You can find us at civichealthall.org. And we really are, .com. And we're really here to help healthcare workers and their communities become more civically engaged, improve healthcare for all communities in the US. And so my hope is that you'll join us. We're doing a campaign right now called 1000 Caring Voices. Anyone, healthcare worker, non-healthcare worker, student, adult, anyone can join us. If you're someone who cares about your community, we're asking people to do things like host dinners and talk to people, write letters to your elected officials, show up for your school boards, anything that shows that you care, sign on. It's free. It's just a way for us to kind of show the world that there are more people who care than don't care. And you can do that again at civichealthall.com.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome, Laura. Thanks for having me.
And now, just a reminder, we have free or low-cost healthcare resources available on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. So check it out. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. And now our experts will answer your health insurance. So welcome to Louise Norris, Health Insurance and Healthcare Reform Analyst at healthinsurance.org. Welcome, Louise.
Thanks, Laura. Great to be here.
So let's start with Zacket from Reddit, who says that my wife used to have a corporate job where we were both covered through her employer. She recently left that job and started a company of her own. Our COBRA coverage runs out in July, and now we both have to get health insurance. The problem I'm facing is she makes more money than I do, and our total income is high enough that I don't qualify for a subsidy. Even the cheapest plan is double what I can afford to spend monthly. So, Louise, this goes back to the Affordable Care Act subsidies not being renewed, and middle class families on the higher end, you know, really having a lack of options. So can you tell us what's going on and what people can do?
Sure. And in this case, it sounds like this is a, you know, this person is talking about their spouse making more than they do, but they want to both get their own health insurance and specifically not qualifying for subsidies because of their spouse's income. So I do just want to clarify that when it comes to marketplace subsidies, it is always household income, and married couples have to file their taxes jointly in order to qualify for subsidies. So even though some couples do choose to keep their finances really separate, there's no such thing as separate finances when it comes to marketplace subsidies if you are married. So in this case, it sounds like one spouse makes quite a bit of money, the other spouse makes less money, and maybe if they were on their own, they might qualify for subsidies, but you can't do that. You do have to put in your total household income, and then you can't do a married filing separately tax return and get subsidies. So just to clarify that right out of the gates. So it is, as you were mentioning, there are no longer any subsidies available if your total household income is over 400% of the federal poverty level. So if you're in the continental United States, that's $84,600 in total household income this year if you're a household of two. So if the spouse's income is putting you over that level, then neither one of you will qualify for a marketplace subsidy. And notice this person mentioned that they both need to get their own individual policies. And so another thing I want to clarify is, even though it's called the individual market, you can certainly buy a policy together. In fact, that is what most people do. If you're married, most of the time, married couples will choose one policy where they're both covered in the individual market. You don't have to do that. Certainly each spouse can pick their own individual market plan. They can be totally separate plans, but you can get on the same policy. And then it sounds like this household won't qualify for subsidies, so you'd be paying full price. But then once you get that premium, you can split it however you want within your own household. It's not like the marketplace is forcing you to each pay half of it. You can break that down however you feel like. Another thing to note here is HSA contributions, health savings account contributions, and pre-tax retirement plan contributions will reduce your household income because of the way that household income is calculated under the ACA. So if the spouse has an option to set up maybe a solo 401k or a simple IRA, a SEP IRA, anything like that, those have fairly high contribution limits depending on how much you put into that. Could potentially get the household income down to where subsidies are available. And if you buy a bronze plan in the marketplace, any bronze plan, it is HSA eligible and will allow you to put money in the health savings account, which also brings down your income. So, I mean, obviously, if this household is earning $500,000 a year, then there's nothing you can do to get subsidies. But if you're earning maybe, say, $100,000 a year, and you're over that $84,600 limit, but not drastically so, it is possible through retirement plan contributions and HSA contributions to potentially get yourself into that subsidy eligible territory. So just a bunch of things there to think about. The other last thing I would point out is that since you mentioned that the spouse is setting up a business with some friends, it sounds like there's more than one person working on it there. They could potentially sign up for a small group health insurance plan and then add the spouse on just as a spouse. You don't have to be employed there, but the small group plan option is potentially an option to look into as well. So lots of different things for this couple to keep in mind, but hopefully I've covered the details there.
Thank you, Louise. And also, it is March. There is time before April 15th to make tax changes. You should talk to a tax professional about that.
Yes, and you also have until next April, just to clarify on the like retirement plan, you know, if you're contributing to an IRA or an HSA and you're including that in your projection for 2026 income, you don't have to make those contributions right now. You have all the way until next April 15th to make those contributions. You do have to make them if you're, because you have to reconcile the subsidies when you file your taxes next year, but it's not something you have to have done already when you're setting up the plan. So just talk to an accountant is a really good piece of advice.
Yes. Our next question is from Flap Flop Flippers, who said that I had an echocardiogram earlier this year. I received the benefits statement for it, and it says I owe about $2,400 for the procedure. There's a column for insurance adjustments on the form, which shows $0, no adjustment made. I called my insurance to get answers, and they told me that even though the place is in network, they're not contracted. They said if I met my deductible already, I'd be paying coinsurance, but this person hasn't met the deductible and has to pay the full cost. So they want to know, I've never heard of a provider or facility being in network with insurance, but not being contracted. So what's going on here?
Yeah, this is a great question. I would call again because something doesn't make sense. In network does mean contracted. Some plans have tiered networks where you have like the tier one providers and pay enrollees get a lower cost if they go to the tier one providers versus tier two providers. But in any case, if the provider is in network, there is a contract and there is a contracted rate. It sounds like, there's a few different things that could have happened. The claim might not have been processed correctly. That's a possibility. It's possible the provider just knew the contracted rate and just chose to bill that rate. Normally what you'll see is the provider will bill their sort of retail rate, their billed rate, and then the insurance plan will reduce that down to whatever the contracted network rate is. And you'll see that written off on the billing statement. But if the $2,400, if the provider already knew that that was what was the contracted rate and they just bill that rate, then there wouldn't be any adjustment to make. So that is possible. I would advise calling again to the health plan and talking to a different representative and sort of digging in a little bit more on the nuance here. And then also calling the medical office and asking them, you know, do you have a standard practice of just billing the contracted rate? Because the medical office also has received this EOB. The EOB gets sent to the medical office and the patient. So if I were this patient, I would call the medical office and say, does this seem right to you? Do you normally get EOBs that show that that there's no write-off amount? And ask them to explain it as well. So that's my advice on that one.
Thank you, Louise. And next, the question from UD Kate, who says that I just left state government employment to work for a major healthcare corporation. My husband still works for the government, and I will have his coverage as secondary. That plan requires the spouse to accept primary insurance through their employer if offered. My question is, since I have a secondary insurance option, should I get the cheapest possible plan for my primary insurance? The HSA costs a great deal more, as does the second tier gold plan. The first tier silver plan is cheaper. And this person says they have a significant amount of appointments. So this person uses a lot of healthcare. So given that they have a secondary plan, what should they do for their primary health insurance?
Yeah. So my first thing that I would advise on this is confirm whether it's actually a better deal for you to maintain both a primary and a secondary insurance. And this is going to depend on how much is being taken out of your husband's check to cover you. It's possible. I mean, if you have children on the plan as well, it's possible it's just a family rate and that you it wouldn't save any money to take you off that plan. If that's the case, then obviously, yes, you should keep the secondary plan. But if an additional amount is being taken out of your husband's paycheck every month for to have you covered on his plan, it's not a given that you want to keep that. You want to look at the total price to buy, say, the best plan that's available to just you through your new employer, and what the total premiums would be there and the total out-of-pocket costs, and then compare that with the total premiums for buying like one of the lesser plans on your that's offered to you, in addition to the premium for having the secondary coverage through your husband. And there's no right or wrong answer here. It will depend on the numbers. So you might find that you come out ahead buying one of the more robust plans that's offered to you and dropping the coverage through your that you get through your husband's job, or exactly what you suggested, buying one of the lower cost plans through your job and then continuing to keep your husband's coverage as secondary. The way that will work, you will need to make sure that like you're in network with the with your husband's plan, so that they do cover the charges, and pay attention to anything if they have like prior authorization requirements, anything like that. But assuming that you're in network and following all the plan's rules, what will happen is even if you buy one of the lower cost plans available through your employer, and it leaves you with fairly significant out-of-pocket costs, the claim will then get sent to the secondary insurance that you have through your husband's job, and they will pay the out-of-pocket costs that you had left under your own plan up to whatever the limits are of that policy. So between the two, you should end up with quite low out-of-pocket costs. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean that when you add in the premiums for both plans, that that's your best option. So I would say take into account all those different numbers before you make a decision.
Thank you, Louise. And thank you, everybody, for joining us to learn more about how healthcare works or doesn't work in America. Please be sure to check out more free or low-cost healthcare resources on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. Join us next week for more Care Talk. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Laura Packard, and this is Care Talk.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.